This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Good evening. This is Rod Cash, your host this week on The People Speak. The People Speak invites audience participation. You can listen by phone calling 716-748-0144. Or if you have a smartphone or a computer, go to bbsradio.com, navigate to station 2, click on the listen icon. You can also participate during the show with call-in questions for our guests, toll-free USA and Canada, 888-429-5471. Joining me live from Montreal, Canada, Leah Tarachansky is a Yapa-based filmmaker and the Israel-Palestine correspondent for the Real News Network, where she produces short documentary-style reports exploring the context of the news. In 2012, Tara produced and co-directed with British journalist Phil Coller a BBC World documentary about the Israeli social injustice. The name of the documentary is On the Side of the Road, and people, you need to see this documentary. It is incredible. It's an incredible piece of history that me as a Palestinian, I didn't even know a lot of this stuff went on, and I didn't know that I knew that the cities were there, and I knew that there was a Nakba, but I didn't know the entire devastation of cities completely gone and turned into, or villages turned into parks for the Israelis. Tara, Leah, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Leah, what inspired you to do this documentary? It was awesome.
Thank you very much. Actually, I started working on the film on an earlier version of the film, and it was going to be called something else in 2009. And what happened was that someone sent me a clip of an Israeli veteran called Tikva Honik Parnas, where she talks about having erased from her memories all of the villages that her unit helped expel and destroy. And that years later, years after 1948, driving down the road between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, she was driving with a friend of hers who happens to be Palestinian, and he pointed to an empty hilltop and said the name of a village that he said used to be there. And that really sort of rose out from what she calls the depths of her denial, the memories that she completely buried somewhere deep down in her memory of having expelled these villages and walking through the empty villages and seeing that on some of the houses, on the tables, there were dishes and shoes by the door, and indicating that the people who lived in these houses, in these villages, had to flee immediately because as a result of the Israeli invasion. Having walked through those empty houses and having enjoyed the beauty of the land, you know, she completely erased those memories. And so when I was watching this clip on YouTube, I was astonished because as an Israeli, you know, I grew up in Israel. I grew up on the normal Israeli diet of something along the lines of Zionist history and mythology and the history of the Holocaust. And I had never heard anything about expulsions. I was never taught anything really about 48 other than it was a miraculous victory of David versus Goliath and all that. And here was an Israeli woman, an Israeli veteran, someone who, you know, the veterans of 1948 are considered the heroes of the nation, the salt of the earth in Israel. And here's this woman, and she's talking about war crimes in that war, which was, of course, always taught to us as something, you know, almost mythological. And so it really shook me to the core. And I decided to do a film. Now, I'm a journalist, my approach was at first I wanted to do a journalistic film and get experts and the historians and to really understand what happened in that year, because I figured if I don't know, obviously other Israelis don't know, and if it had such a strong impact on me, it would have on other Israelis. But what happened was that as I was collecting that film, I was shooting those interviews and and speaking and doing a lot of archival history research. And I ended up spending more than a year doing research for that film as I was discovering the details of what happened in 1948. And even more importantly, what happened in the 2-3 years immediately after the war, when more than 500 villages were completely destroyed, thousands of places were renamed from the Palestinian names to the Israeli names, and trees and forests were and parks were planted on the remains of these emptied villages. This to build the landscape, which builds a Jewish continuity on the land. As I was discovering the details behind all of these things, which, of course, if you grow up in Israel, you're born in Israel, you walk through these parks, you know, on your vacations, you walk through these streets on the these changed, you know, these streets with changed names. You grow up in a landscape that doesn't have anything Palestinian. And in your consciousness, you don't even have Palestine or Palestinians as some kind of, as a uniform nation of people who have political and national aspirations. You're taught from age zero that there's an Arab mass of enemies, they are, you know, homogeneous, and they just want to kill you. And so as I was discovering in my research that much of what I learned was mythology, I was talking to everyone around me about what I was discovering. And I found that even though I could bring now to the argument facts that I didn't have before, it wasn't really having much of an impact on the people that I was talking to. I wasn't getting this, oh my God, reaction that I thought I should be getting. Instead, what would happen would be that I would bring to the table this huge mass of research and facts, and people would just bring their own facts, and it would end up being this argument about what happened in 1928 and what happened in 1929 and who killed who in 1936. And it was not about it wasn't really about the content, it wasn't about the point. And to me, the point was that I finally understood that for the creation of Israel, Palestine had to be destroyed and erased. And this very simple truth is something that you don't put two and two together when you grow up in Israeli media in that landscape of that education and that constant indoctrination into we are right, we are always right, we are pure of arms, we never did anything wrong, we're eternal perfect victims, and the Arabs are just an extension of the Nazis and so on. And so what I found was that there was a personal element to the story here that I wasn't penetrating to. And what happened was that I finally understood that when the Palestinians were talking, they were speaking about the Nakba, the catastrophe of 1948. They were talking about living in exile. They were talking about living under occupation. They were talking about being bombed. And when the Israelis were talking, they were talking about the Holocaust. And they were talking about, you know, anti-Semitism and terrorism. And so the two sides, if you can call them sides, were talking about totally different things. And so the film really evolved as I understood that. And I started, instead of reaching out to historians, reaching out to veterans and seeing if I could get their stories. And of course, I found that woman who was in the clip originally that I told you about, and I interviewed her, and I found a few others. And what I discovered talking to them over the 4 years it took to film this movie is that their struggle to tell the camera what they did was a metaphor for the entire collective consciousness, in a sense, because you can see through their struggle that even though they want to open that door, every step of the way, they basically encounter something that is so painful that they can't touch. And that, of course, comes from their deeply profound understanding that we are the perpetrators here. From 1948 to today, we are the powerful. We are the ones who are privileged and who benefit from the situation. Not all of us, of course. I mean, I'm generalizing here. But by and large, Israelis don't suffer the way that Palestinians suffer from this conflict, certainly don't pay as big of a price. And so as I was, you know, questioning them year after year, interview after interview, I would see them sort of going to this deeper and deeper spiral of personal denial that really represented a collective denial. And so the film evolved over those years, and the final version known as On the Side of the Road, which you can see the trailer for on narrativeproductions.com. That version of that film is a very personal story of people who tackle their own denial as a metaphor for the collective denial of our society. And you see that whenever some Israelis who are no longer in denial try to present that truth to their society, to their brothers, to their neighbors, they're met with violence and dismissal. And it's a very tough environment in which to raise these kinds of questions. And led me to conclude that one of the most basic elements of the Israeli DNA is knowing what questions you cannot ask. Because once you start asking these questions, the entire mythological string starts to unravel. And then nothing that you could before plaster into some kind of justification holds up anymore.
Right, and correct. And this has always pretty much been my argument with Israelis, is that, you know, you're saying that God brought you back to the land, but you're not from the land to begin with. I'm sorry, but, you know, the indigenous Judeans that converted to Islam and Christianity first and then Islam, following Jesus and then following Muhammad, they never went anywhere. Those people were still there. They are the same people that are there. The Jewish, the Yiddish, came from Europe. And a lot of people don't really know the history of that until they look deeper. I didn't even, as a Palestinian, I did not know the history of it myself until I started researching the origins of the Sephardim and the Ashkenaz and everything else. And my biggest battle with most Israelis is, you know, we don't care. We can all live together. We're all human beings and everything else. But you make the claim, but can you tell me which biblical tribe you're from? And I don't see Ashkenaz or Sephardim listed as one of the biblical tribes or the 12 tribes. So can you please tell me where you're from? What gives you more?
I think you're mixing a couple of things up here.
Okay.
What you're talking about is widely known in Israel as the Shlomo Send argument, which is that the Jews were never expelled by the Romans, that the majority of them actually stayed and were then converted to Christianity and Islam and became what we know today as the Palestinians. And that is certainly true. But there was also an exodus during the Roman Empire in 70 AD, and those Jews actually went east and then went north and then trekked across Europe to Spain and were, as we all know, expelled by the Spanish in 1492, and went back east and formed what we now know as Ashkenazim. But Ashkenazim and Sephardim are terms invented by the Gentiles to describe various waves of Jews. These are terms that are used to describe what happened to the Jews after the Roman exodus. So, you know, I mean, and to confuse the history of the Jews with Zionism, I think, is a massive mistake. And it's a mistake that people who both support Zionism and are against it make. And essentially, Zionism, which is the idea that was formed in the mind, of Theodor Herzl in the 1800s, when he saw that European anti-Semitism was so severe that the Jews are never going to have a peaceful life in Europe, and they had to basically take advantage of the colonial powers at the time and offer themselves as a colonial, you know, population to go take up some third world country. You know, originally he was thinking about Uganda. He was thinking about other places. And then finally he got to the conclusion that he's not going to be able to convince most Jews to make that move unless he was arguing based on the religious element, which of course would take them to Jerusalem, to Zion, which is where the term Zionism comes from. But Zionism is a very young political movement. It's only 150 years old. And in fact, Theodor Herzl, who came up with the idea, he died, you know, a broke and hopeless man, having concluded that in the early 20th century that his dream is never going to come true, that Israel will never be created. And then, and as we know, until the Holocaust, Zionism was a tiny movement amongst very few Jews in Europe and wasn't getting much ground. And even after the Holocaust, even after 6 million Jews were murdered by the Nazis, you know, and there were 4 million refugees left all over Europe, when the European countries and United States and Canada got together, they came to the conclusion that they don't want those refugees. Canada famously said, the Prime Minister of Canada, Mackenzie, he said, none is too many. Not one even is, zero is too many Jews in my country. America, the same thing. The United States agreed to take only 100,000 Jews. And so the remaining refugees were put by Zionists on boats and shipped to what was then British Palestine. But even when they came to Israel, or what was then Palestine, they walked into a very low-level civilian conflict between, you know, the early Zionists and the Palestinians. And they were given weapons, and they were basically told, now is your chance. After the war, of course, you know, after the dust settled in 1948, 3 years after the Holocaust, then you can come and say what you want. But the majority of Israelis today don't come from Europe. Most of these Israelis today, most of the Jewish people in Israel, actually come from North Africa. You know, they come from the East. They come from places like Iran and Iraq and from Yemen. They come from Russia. You know, that's the majority of people that live today in Israel as Jews. The Ashkenazim, the Jews that came from West Europe and founded the state, are now a minority. And this, of course, creates a huge demographic problem, because what you end up with is you have Jewish Arabs and Muslim Arabs who are killing each other in order to profit the Jews that came from Europe. And when we're looking at the segregations and the various levels of oppression inside the Jewish community in Israel, you see very clear segregations based on when a community came. In Israel, we have zero mobility in terms of classes. If you are born poor, you will die poor. The chances of you stepping out of poverty into a working class is almost zero. And if you are born rich, which happens, most of those in power in Israel come from West Europe or the Ashkenazi Jews, you know, you can inherit that wealth and live well. And so you have huge disparities amongst the Jews, all in the name of this idea of Zionism. So I think that it's a mistake to basically stereotype all Israeli Jews as colonialists that came from Europe. As I said, most of the Jews in Israel today are not even from Europe, and came for various reasons. So the story of Zionism and the story of this conflict is really quite complex. And it's one of the reasons why my film doesn't go into all of these elements of the history. My film talks about Israeli collective denial today and where it comes from, and how deeply it's entrenched inside of a people that is basically not forced to examine it. And the reason it's not forced to examine it is because it's easy to indoctrinate a people that wants to be indoctrinated.
Correct. And you can't force people against their will to just give up everything that they have, forget everything, and just move on as if nothing has happened, when nobody is apologetic. But the problem today is that it doesn't seem like there's any remorse, and the onslaught is going on and on and on. In my studies, I've come across articles where the Ashkenaz, the richer, higher level Jews, were handing some of the lower class Jews over to Hitler and the Nazis and stuff like that. A lot of different studies. But, you know, stories are all out there, but nobody really does the history about what's going on. Now, what I need to say here is, do you know about the Great Book Robbery? I'm sure you've...
Yep, it's a great documentary.
Right. I look at it this way. Why would you need to steal history books of another people if you are the indigenous people returning and you have history there?
What I'm saying is that it's not a narrative. It's not a conflict of narratives.
Right.
I mean, you have a million and one witnesses who will tell you a million and one stories about an event, but there is also objective truth. And it's not about the books. I mean, The Great Robbery, if you've watched it, it's about how in the 2-3 years immediately after 1948, four very important laws were put into place, which basically cemented that Israel is the Jewish state for the Jewish people and the Jewish people only. The first of which was that all the properties of the Palestinians that were expelled were appropriated into a body that the government just created out of thin air. They took the lands, they took the houses, they took all the agriculture, and of course they also took the books. What the documentary you're talking about says is that the problem here was their colonial mentality. For example, some of the other laws they put into place was the anti-infiltration law of 1951 that says that all the Palestinians that left are not allowed to come back to, for example, take something from the houses that they were expelled from, or to harvest their agricultural products so that they can survive as refugees. that law basically prevented any returns. And that's the same law that Israel today uses against African refugees seeking asylum in Israel. The other law, for example, that they put into place is the law of return that says that only Jewish people can immigrate to Israel. And that basically prevented any return of Palestinians or anybody else. You, if you're not a Jew, you can't move to Israel. It's not like the United States. You can't just immigrate there. and of course, the most important law that they passed in those first few years had to do with the land. And in my opinion, that's the biggest robbery, because today we live in a situation where 96% of the land of Israel, whether it's public or private, belongs to Jewish people in the benefit of the Jewish people. You know, more than 60% of that is the government, and 13% is the Jewish National Fund, which explicitly says that its lands are for the benefit of the Jewish people and the Jewish people only, which means that 22% of the population, which is not Jewish, almost a quarter of the population, which is not Jewish, has access to only 3% of the land. And that's the land on which the Palestinians who were not expelled live. You know, and now it's four generations later, and they still only have that little piece of land. And so the elements by which the new Jewish state took control over all the resources of the Palestinians and rewrote history, erased the landscape, those are the methods that created the kind of environment in which you have massive collective denial in Israel about the tragedy that happened there, because of which Israel exists. And I think that until we look in the mirror as Israelis about what was the price that was paid and by whom for us to have what we have, and until we are accounted for that, until there is justice, there will never be peace. And this is something that, you know, it takes education, it takes, being able to have some kind of self-reflection, having a national level conversation the same way that Germany had after the Second World War, the same way that the French had after moving out of Algeria, the same way that the whites in South Africa had. We're going to have a national conversation when this thing comes to heads. And what my film is saying, basically, or is trying to say, is the first step is to ask questions. If you don't ask those questions, you're basically saying, I don't want to know the answers. And we have to know the answers if we're going to have an honest some semblance of peaceful transition into a post-colonial reality in which we are not occupying millions of people, in which we are not constantly bombing, you know, basically an open-air prison, in which we are not constantly at war with all of our enemies. And this is something that I deeply believe all Israelis want. And I deeply believe this is what the Palestinians want, and of course everyone in the region. But as you and I know, there are people who profit from this situation, and those people are the ones who are maintaining the current status quo.
Absolutely. And this is what I keep trying to tell a lot of my Israeli friends, is that what they don't realize is that we're all victims of these profiteers. Whether we're Jewish, whether we're Christian, whether we're Muslim, everybody, we're all victims of it. What we need to do is all unite in humanity as human beings. But getting past what you said, the denial stage, or should I say the arrogance stage of those, well, we're here, we're Israeli, we're going to stay no matter what. And instead of saying, okay, well, how can we work forward? They're saying, well, there's never going to be a Palestinian state. This is the type of attitude and mentality that with some people that we're dealing with. And I'm sure you've come across that yourself.
Of course, but there's intransigence, ignorance, and barbarity on both sides. I just think that we have access to a lot more media to broadcast ours. And of course, Israelis, you know, intransigence has a much bigger impact. But there's idiots everywhere.
Yeah, that's absolute and absolutely correct. We're going to take a quick break, Tia. We'll be right back. People, go out and see her movie or go online, and you can probably download the live stream from her movie. It's called On the Side of the Road. It is a tremendous documentary, and it shows a lot. It shows what was there and what's there now, and what a difference. You will see the villages that were completely annihilated. And also, we spoke earlier, Tara, you and I on the phone, and we spoke about the massacre. So we'll come back to that when we come back. We'll be back in just a few minutes with our guest, Leah Tarachansky. This is Rakesh on the BBS Radio Network, and the people speak.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Today's school libraries are filled with endless opportunities. With access to print and digital materials, the latest technologies, and the guidance of a school librarian, our children are empowered with the tools they need to succeed in school and beyond. I'm Julianne Moore. Join me in celebrating all of the ways that school libraries and librarians are transforming learning for our students. For more information on how you can become involved, visit the American Association of School Librarians at aasl.org.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Welcome back to The People Speak. This is your host, Rob Cash, with our guest, Leah Tarachansky, here on The People Speak. Leah, before we left, we were talking about your documentary, On the Side of the Road. What was it for you as you visited those villages and you looked at the pictures and you seen what was there, but then, you know, later on you see a park that was funded and paid for by Canada or
Australia or the U.S.
Right.
Sure, of course. For me, it was a number of stages. First, I understood the occupation, and only years later, I understood the Nakba. So first, I understood what happened in 67 because it's so visceral. It's so in your face. You're seeing, you know, concrete checkpoints and army and, you know, night invasions and mass arrests and all that. It's very visceral. It doesn't take much to see it and say, oh, my God, this is wrong. But it took years for me to understand that what is going on in the occupied territories today and what started in 67 that led to now 5 million people living statelessly as subjects of the Israeli military, that started in 48. I mean, of course, the conflict didn't start in 1948, but in 48, it was massively transformed and the dispossession of the Palestinians completely changed in 48. So to make that connection, to understand 48 is to understand everything that happened after. And so I had already even started working on the film before I really internalized that. And what happened was that as I, you know, I was working as a journalist in D.C., and when I started working on the film, I moved back to Israel. And I come from a West Bank settlement. I grew up in a settlement between Ramallah and Nablus.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a space which is, you know, a settlement, if you've ever been in one, a colony, it's a very Israeli space. there's obviously no Palestinians in the settlements, and even though it's right in the middle of the Palestinian West Bank, it's a completely segregated society. It's almost like some kind of island suspended from the sky by strings. It's so divorced from its landscape and its surroundings, and it's intentionally built that way. And so I had growing up in the middle of the Palestinian West Bank in an Israeli settlement, had never actually interacted with Palestinians in any way. I'd never met Palestinians in any way. The only times I knew anything or heard anything about the Palestinians, it was about them trying to kill us in one way or another. And so in my imagination, the only thing I knew or thought about the Palestinians is that they just want to kill me. And then after I had moved back to Israel, having undergone this massive political transformation, I went back to my settlement and I crossed the road and I went back to the, and I went to the villages across the highway. And for the first time met those people and talked to them, and was, I have to say that even though my mind already understood what was happening, my heart had taken a long time to basically catch up. And as I was standing there in the village across the highway from my settlement, I just remember being terrified for my life and being certain that at any moment they're going to turn around and kill me. And this irrational fear haunted me for years after I started as a journalist to cover the occupation and go in and out of the West Bank a lot and see some of the biggest, you know, atrocities that happen daily there. And go deep into the Palestinian cities, including to cities from which come people that have killed friends of mine, you know, and people that I love. And to finally cross those boundaries, that finally led me to understand that the fear that I was feeling was an irrational fear, that the Palestinian people are a people and that all they really want is to have a normal, quiet life. You know, the aspiration of the vast majority of the people there is to just have a normal North American, boring suburban life. That's what we're fighting for here. And so even after making that transition, it took me a long time to go to a village in 48 that was destroyed. Because, of course, these, it's not like there's a sign there that says here was a Palestinian village. You know, you're driving down this highway between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, and you don't know that there were 18 villages along the highway, in the place of which are now beautiful, rolling, foresty hills. And so what happened was I went with Zochot, which is an Israeli organization that documents this history in Hebrew for Israelis to confront. And they organized tours for Israelis to these villages. And so I went on one of their tours, and we happened to go to a place that, as a child, I used to go to a lot on vacation. It's one of these sort of like family forests, you know, where you have a place to do barbecue and walk in the forest and whatever. And so for me, it was such a neutral, such a sweet memory to this place. You know, it was such a positive, totally positive space. And to be there for the first time with photographs, because, of course, this is not something that happened in ancient history. This is something that happened just yesterday. The people who did this are still alive. We have photographs of what was there. And to stand in the hill that, you know, I used to go and play with my friends as a kid, to stand there and look at a photograph of a village that used to be there not that long ago and whose residents are not, did not evaporate into thin air. They're still alive. They live in Gaza, and their descendants live in Gaza, and their grandkids live in Gaza, and they still live in the same refugee camp, still waiting to go back to what is now an empty hill covered in forests and picnic tables and barbecues. And to see that, and to see the banality of how easy it is to completely transform a place, to completely erase an entire history, an entire people, and to do it completely, you know, without blinking an eye, without stopping for a second to say, is what we're doing here an atrocity? That was, for me, I mean, I could never, it broke me as a person. It broke everything that I knew until that point to be true. And the worst part of it was actually a moment that's in the film where I was interviewing one of the veterans, and he's talking about a village in the south of the country where he participated in a massive massacre, and they ended up burying more than 70 people in a mass grave. And he was talking about this place, and I went and I found in the archives an aerial photograph of that place that was taken in 1947, 1 year before the massacre. And so I went on Google Earth and I found the same place today, and I juxtaposed one image over the other, and I just I just started to cry, because you see today on Google Earth the outline, the exact outline of the same village, except the outline is made of trees. And you can see that wherever there was a house, there is now just a tree left. And the houses are gone, the people are gone, the village is gone, but its outline remains. Right. And in that way, nature has somehow, you know, almost magically resisted being erased, resisted that memory being erased, their memory. And they actually, the people who were expelled from that village also live in Gaza. And I went to that village, and I went to that place, and it's just, and to stand inside of that grove now.
Did you also speak with the family in Gaza?
In a roundabout way, I did. But just to finish, to stand in that place, you can hear the ghosts of the people who live there. You can smell them. You can taste them in the air. You can taste them in the soil. They are there, and they're going to be haunting this place until this conflict is resolved. And they're allowed to return. And then a few months ago, as I was presenting my film in Norway, I was speaking on a panel with someone who is from Gaza. And as I was telling that story, he said, "Wait a minute, what's the name of the village?" And I told him, and he says, "This is the village of my grandparents." And this is something that happens to me constantly abroad. You know, I'm talking about this place or that place, and someone says, "This is where my grandparents are from." So that memory is alive and well, and has been inherited, just like the trauma of the Holocaust, from generation to generation. And until it is resolved, until some kind of, you know, modicum of justice is seen, we're never going to have peace.
I could see that. I've got a caller from Australia that wants to ask a question. Steve from Australia, go ahead, please.
Thank you very much, sir. God bless you first, ma'am, for all the work you're doing. My first question is, did you get a lot of blowback from other Israelis when you made these documentaries?
Thank you for the question. I want to say that I'm, you know, I don't, in Hebrew, I don't have an accent. I don't wear a hijab. I have a Jewish name, and I'm mostly, and I look white. So I can pass for a lot of privilege in Israel. And so the violence that you actually see perpetrated daily is not against people that look like me. So I get away with a lot. But to answer your question, you know, it's not an easy film to watch. And as you can imagine, a lot of people have negative reactions to it. But that's what I expected when I made it. And, you know, that's why I made the film.
Bravo.
One final question. Do you see modern Israelis waking up more and more to this historical truth?
That's a complicated answer. So what happened was that 30 years after 48, the Israel the Zionist archives were opened, as were the UN archives and the British archives. And so these historians would go into the archives for the first time in 1978 and start digging up a lot of the documents that were there. And they actually became the first historians of Israel. These are people that you probably have heard of, Benny Morris, Ilan Pape, Zev Sternhall, people like that, people who, Avi Schleim, people who became known as the new historians. And so when they were publishing their work in the 80s, they were basically opening wide a door that was completely closed. And we saw that their work had a lot of impact, both on the social justice movement that arose in 1982 against the Lebanon War, and also, you know, the first Intifada that started in 87. And so in the 90s, you had this mass wave of awakening in Israel where people were discovering these facts, because, of course, their parents would never talk to them about what they did in 1948, so they actually didn't know. But that was in the 80s and 90s. What happened is that under Netanyahu's first government in 1996, his Ministry of Culture basically went through Ministry of Education went through all the history books and removed any of the material that was discovered by the new historians. And so basically in one swoop reversed all the progress that was made. Now, you know, it's not even 1996 anymore. We're now in 2015, and many processes have happened since then. We've had the second Intifada. We had the beginning and the collapse of the peace negotiations under Oslo. And today, you can't say that the average Israeli doesn't know that something horrific happened in 48 that the Israelis are responsible for. You can no longer say we don't know. But denial is not a yes or no. It's not a light switch that goes from off to on. It's a process, and it has many stages, as we know from people who study personal denial to people who study collective denial. And where we are as an Israeli society today is no longer at the stage of I didn't know that something happened because of all the things that I said. The next stage after that is, okay, maybe something happened, but it's not as bad as it sounds. We are even not at that stage anymore. We are now at the stage that says, okay, something happened, and it was terrible, but it was justified, or, but it's not me. And so, and this is a very important phase, in my opinion, because it's right, it is exactly the last point before a person has to basically take responsibility for their own, actions and for their own privilege, and to face up to what they've done. And as a society, we're not that far away from that stage, because that last stage of, I don't care what happened, even if something atrocious happened, it's justified. That's where we are today. And as a society, you can't stay in that space for very long, because of course that argument sounds hollow when you kill, 2,200 people in Gaza every summer, and the world publishes reports saying that you're a war criminal.
Correct.
Any more questions? Thank you very much, ma'am.
Great. Thank you, Steve. Thanks for calling. What do you think of the Netanyahu regime and his government, Leah?
I think that the Netanyahu regime Netanyahu's fourth government is the closest government that we've ever had in Israel's history to a fascistic regime. But I don't think that it's got a lot to do with Netanyahu. I think that Netanyahu's government is appealing to the most populist, most base elements in our society. And as a trend in the world, whether it's European fascism, whether it's Le Pen in France, or the Harper regime in Canada, these are trends that are popular today. As the world kind of twitches its last twitch before admitting that global capitalism, a global capital has to come hand in hand with global migration, because we are still in denial of that very basic fact. These are popular ideas. These ethnocratic ideas of having a nation that belongs to one ethnic group, the friends belonging to the French, Russia belonging to the Russians, all these mythologies about that nations have about being pure societies. Because Netanyahu knows that this is a popular belief or a popular worldview today, not just even in Israel, but around the world, he's playing up to that very base populist view, and his regime represents that. But I think that it's special in Israel because he's leaning not just on these, extremely right-wing backwards ideas, but he's also leaning on the most racist version of Zionism that you have, which says that Israel is a country of Jews and only for Jews, and that only Jews should have rights there, and even almost half his government in one way or another supports ethnic cleansing or genocide. So we're talking about an extremely right-wing government. We have parties in parliament that actively argue for the ethnic cleansing of minorities from Israel. This is where we are today. But I think that Netanyahu, while playing to these elements in Israeli society, he's really exposing the worst elements of Zionism. And this is something that has helped activists around the world. I mean, Netanyahu, as Omar Barghouti says, is the biggest closet supporter of the boycott movement, because he goes up on the world stage and he says things that are overtly racist and overtly discriminatory, such as before, the day of the election, saying, Jews run to the polls and vote because the Arab minority is running and they're, the Arab hordes are trying to vote. These are citizens in a country that calls itself democratic. Imagine if an American white presidential candidate was saying, hey, white people, you got to run to the polls because the Mexicans are trying to vote, alongside with you, Mexican citizens of the U.S. I mean, it's such an overtly discriminatory and racist, stance, and his whole government represents this. So I think that, there's not much to be said about it. These are the most mediocre and criminal elements in Israeli society, and we've seen now that, corruption in Israel has skyrocketed under Netanyahu, and the the gaps between the rich and the poor have, you know, doubled in terms of Israel today is second only to the U.S. in the gap between the rich of the and the poor in the entire developed world. And we're seeing that there's now more civil strife inside the Jewish community in Israel than ever in the country's history. And we have more members of parliament, sitting members of parliament, that are outwardly fascists.
Right, so it's the Ashkenaz that are pretty much calling themselves the one percenters, because I've seen this one guy that is always on the show, The Shark, and this guy was saying, well, people need to look up to the one percenters. Well, yeah, you know, we thumb at people like that. But with what's going on right now, I have a question that I don't know if you can answer or not, but it's I got to ask because it's the audience. Fred in Kentucky wants to know, does Israeli intelligence agencies ever use Muslim as patsies or agents for their operations?
Yes. There's the problem of collaboration is a massive problem in Palestine, and is the result of basically, you know, years of rule. What we have today in Israel, at least in the occupied territories, is a massive network of surveillance, which is of course powered by the Israeli intelligence agencies, but is employs, you know, both active agents on the ground and regular civilians. So for example, if you are a Palestinian who happens to have been born in the West Bank and you need to get access to a medical facility in Israel or abroad, or maybe you got into a university in New York or somewhere outside the West Bank, you need to travel or you need to work, you need to get a permit from the Israeli military. You need to get a permit for almost anything from the Israeli military if you live under the occupation. And when that happens, when you go and you apply for that permit, you undergo an interrogation, basically, by the Israeli security services, where they more often than not suggest that if you want to go to that university, if you want to get that surgery, you better tell us something about your neighbor, or you better, you know, spy for us, or do some kind of task for us when you get to the other side. And so this creates an entire sort of network of surveillance over the entire population, where people don't even talk about politics around the dinner table anymore because they're afraid that grandpa might need a surgery in the future and is going to be interrogated by the Israeli Security Service and is going to have to say something about his grandson. And of course, under the occupation, anything can be a crime, right? There's no law per se. The military of Israel, the chief of the military, writes an order, and it becomes magically becomes law. So the law that governs, you know, millions of people, millions of Palestinians in the West Bank is basically written by a military general. And so today we're in a situation where you can't gather more than 10 people in a place in the West Bank. You can't have a protest of more than 10 people. You can't legally be in a member of a political party. You know, there's flags that are outlawed. You can't really show dissent in any way. Even if you're in a student group at your university, a political student group, that can be illegal. That could be enough for you to be classified a security threat and sent to jail. So people are forced to spy on each other, and it creates basically this culture of fear and silence. So there's many elements in which that comes into play. But of course, you know, history is not black and white. And since the conflict has started, there have been people on either side that have been used a lot more by Israel of Palestinians for various benefits or for ideologies. And we have actually, you know, well-known neighborhoods in Israel where Palestinian collaborators are resettled after they are involved in some kind of project for the Israeli intelligence.
Oh, wow. Boy, you know, 1 hour is not enough with you, Leah. You're fabulous. I've got a native Canadian, actually another Canadian on the line, one that wants to ask you a question. Go ahead, John.
Yes, hello, Leah. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Thank you very much for your insights. I was wondering if you could confirm or deny and put into context for us Netanyahu's comment that was reported that he would never recognize a state of Palestine. Is that true or not? And could you put it in context? Thank you.
Sure. So Netanyahu was actually elected the very first time right after Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated. And Yitzhak Rabin was basically the first Israeli prime minister to really make possible the idea of a two-state solution. And when he was assassinated by an Israeli right-winger, Netanyahu basically ran on a very similar platform of populism and so on. And to this day, this is more or less his politics. Only once in his entire political career, in 2009, he said that he might consider or might recognize a Palestinian state. In fact, Netanyahu comes from a very right-wing background. His father was someone who believed in massive ethnic cleansing of all of the Palestinians. His brother died in Operation Entebbe, which was an anti-terrorist operation in the 70s. And all of these elements, including, of course, being an extreme right-winger himself, helped shape Netanyahu as the man we know today. But he, you know, in this election, he saw that his plan to the very reason he called for an early election and the only reason we had elections this year is because he was basically losing power as a result of the fact that there was relative quiet in Israel for years under him. You know, most of the Palestinian factions have stopped really fighting Israel. So life in Israel for the Israelis has become more or less quiet. And yet the social and economic situation is only continuing to deteriorate. And of course, that comes from Netanyahu being an extreme capitalist and capitalizing basically all of our industries, our ports, our railways and so on, and creating this huge gap between the rich and the poor in extreme, neoliberal economics. And so when you don't have an enemy to fight, the people start looking internally. And this is largely why he has started the last three wars that we've had. But also it has to do with why he called these early elections. And when he was coming close to the wire, all of a sudden the liberal Zionist party's unity presented a real threat. And his idea that if he calls for an early election, he can take advantage of the lack of governance during that period and actually gain more power, that was coming into question. So again, in the moment, in a critical moment, he appealed to the most base, you know, most sort of, you know, visceral elements of Israeli society that basically say, sure, why not? We can talk about peace, but we're not willing to sacrifice anything for it. And so that's why he said that he won't recognize an Israeli state. And as soon as the international community came knocking the day after the elections, you know, he took it back. So these are meaningless terms. I think that it just goes to show that the peace process as we know it is dead and has been dead for a very long time, and it's meaningless. It hasn't produced any benefits for the Palestinian side. In fact, life for Palestinians has become much, much worse. The number of settlements has doubled and tripled under these peace negotiations. And we've seen the more permanent and more entrenched increase of Israeli military control over the Palestinian population, and Israel having to pay no price since the peace process has started. So I think that's a testament, these kinds of comments, using his positions back and forth, tossing them back and forth to win votes in an election, just goes to show that these peace negotiations the U.S. is supposedly mediating are dead. And I think that this is a very important thing to realize, because it, of course, forces us to say, well, if they're dead, then what's forward? What can we fight for now? What can we get ourselves involved in to end this conflict? And it helps, because we have been stuck, both as a world community and as Israelis on the left in Israel, have been stuck in the discourse of the peace process and the two-state solution for so long that we have stopped to notice that progress is going in the very opposite and very bad direction. And now that we can free ourselves of this discourse, we can actually fight for justice. One person, one vote. To very basic human rights, to basically transform the solidarity movement from one that involves the United States and geopolitical interests to one that involves civil society, you know, nonviolent resistance based on very basic civil rights principles.
All right, we've got another caller, Ziad, on line two, and make it quick because we are running out of time. Go ahead, Ziad.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Zahid, and I think it's a sad state of affairs when, in the 21st century, the taxpayers of America has to pay the Egyptian and the Israeli government so you guys don't kill each other. I think it's pathetic in the Middle East. There's no solution to the Israel-Palestinian situation, and I think the world has spent too much time and resources on you people. The problem is that you guys have been talking to that God for far too long. Too much prophets and messengers of God has came out of the Middle East. And this is the problem. This is the problem there. I mean, so many people have been kicked out of their ancestral homeland right before the state of Israel was formed. A huge part of India was created for the Islamic State of Pakistan. 5 to 6 million Hindus and Sikhs kicked out. No one says
excuse
anything.
Excuse me, sir, but
we are tired.
Is,
we, the civilized world, are tired. We
excuse
are tired
me,
of this
is this
nonsense.
A question?
We
is
are this... tired of the nonsense with the Semitic people and their desert god of Abraham. You people need to try something else. For heaven's sakes, people, try Buddhism. Obviously, Islam and Judaism has been a failure. Thank you.
Yeah, this is a ramble on that calls in every once in a blue moon. So please excuse him, Leah. Leah, thank you so much for being on. I'm sorry we're out of time, but I would love to have you on again, and I would love to talk to you forever because you're a wealth of information and you're such a good-hearted person, and this can be seen and this can be heard in your voice. Thank you so much for joining us here on The People Speak. This is Rakesh signing off for this week. Thank you, Don Newsom at bbsradio.com. And we'll see you next week here on The People Speak. Have a good evening.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief of the summer people. And they stood there hungry when I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.